Always Record, episode 96, from thesyncbook.com.
You know, I just saw a message from Will Morgan saying that he told you about the visitor thing.
Oh, I didn't even notice that. It was just up on my page, so he must be the one that posted it there on my Facebook page.
Yeah. So well,
I didn't realize that he sent me a message. It's fabulous.
Oh, you saw it?
Yeah.
ABBA sync?
With the ABBA, yeah, it's fucking incredible.
Okay.
I couldn't believe it. It was scary, actually.
So
this is one of those things that's I guess part of what we do.
Totally. The process around it, like I was, up for a long time, and I was editing that film together, which was just. The only reason it took so long is because my computer kept on shutting down. My computer's been shutting down every time I try to encode, and I just keep doing it over and over and over again. It just goes, boop, drops, have to restart, try again, it's overheated or something. Anyways, I'm, like, sitting with this film, and I'm just like, I had this crazy, uncanny feeling come over me looking at it, and I was just like, there's something fucking up with this. Like, there is something really up with this. I'm like, there's something here. What the fuck?
Oh, yeah. The whole MGM fire. I distinctly remember that fire from my youth. You were probably pretty young. I was in my late teens when that fire happened.
I wasn't born yet. It was the year before. I mean, I was born in 1981.
Oh, really? So you were born in 82?
I was born in 81. The fire happened.
That's the same year I saw 2001 first time.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
When's your birthday?
December 8th, 1981.
Motherfucker, that's the same day as my sister.
Oh, really? Your sister has Jim Morrison's birthday and John Lennon's death day?
Yeah. Well, John Lennon's death. I didn't realize that was Jim Morrison's birthday. You realize, of course, that it's also the Catholic Feast of the Immaculate Conception.
Yes,
right?
Which is why I titled The Rosemary's Baby.
Of course,
Feast of the Immaculate Conception. But, so that ties into this. Big time. And so, just... because I'm recording this, I don't know if we're going to do anything with it or if I'm just...
Well, just keep chatting. I got nowhere to go right now.
Okay. So, you know, the story is I come across the fact that I'm just like, what day did this movie come out in the U.S.? I just had this, like, sense of, like, that fucking day. And I look it up and boom, there it is, this MGM fire at the MGM Grand.
Unbelievable.
Right, which is in...
Georgia.
Yeah, so Las Vegas... which was Paradise, Nevada. That's what they used to call it. And then I'm like,
that's
Paradise?
Right.
That's the fucking name of the director of The Visitor.
Paradise, so like, yes, yeah.
Yeah, Michael J. Paradise, which isn't his real name, the Michael J. part.
Paradise is his real name.
Right, but...
But first name is not Michael, but nevertheless, yeah.
I think it's John. He does, he has a different name. He comes up with names specifically for films.
Yes,
Yeah. And so I'm like, okay, well, that's fucking weird. But then I'm like, okay, that's this day. And then I watch a news broadcast, which I put at the beginning of the film. And the last thing that he says...
Oh, I know. That was fucking compelling.
Yeah, he's like, this is the second biggest hotel fire in U.S. history. The first was in Atlanta, Georgia. And immediately I'm like, no fucking way, because that's The Visitor takes place in Atlanta, Georgia. And there's that opening shot where they're showing you the Equanimity Building or
Equitable Building.
And I'm like, is the fucking hotel in the shot? And Alex Fulton tells me it is.
Fucking unbelievable.
Not only that, but it shows up elsewhere. And so I'm like, okay, so there's that. The fucking fire escape that drops.
That fire escape scene.
Not only that, but the way everyone's standing around it, looking down at it, the crowd gathers around a fire escape.
There's this fire escape thing
throughout the movie with this fucking brick building, you know, like the red brick building.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
And I remember hearing because I watched about the first whole, like the whole playthrough of the album. I didn't see the second half of the film yet. I was talking to Alex Fulton, actually. He called me up. But one of the things I noticed was that, and like I didn't write it down, but in the opening sequence when the news broadcaster is talking, Doesn't he say that there were 119 people killed in the fire?
Yes.
So you get your 9/11, 119.
Yeah. 119 people.
Yes.
In the original fire in Atlanta, right?
That's right, yes.
But that was December 7th, 1947.
Unbelievable.
The day before Feast of the Immaculate Conception. But the thing is that the day after that, Samuel Goldwyn or whatever, am I pronouncing that wrong, but the G of MGM.
Yeah, that's Samuel Goldwyn. Yeah.
He produced a film that came out the next fucking day that's called The Bishop's Wife, which is all about angels.
I've seen The Bishop's Wife many times. Yeah.
So if you see the connection of the angels...
Oh, of course, the angel coming down to intervene with a problem on Earth, right?
You get it?
Oh, shit me with a shit show.
Yeah, 9/11, fucking December 8th. It's like it's bookend by these two things.
So how many years apart are we talking about there? 33 years. Fucking unbelievable.
33 years, is that right?
Well, sure, 47 to 80.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Right? And so, and then if you look at the MGM Grand, you're looking at a Mayan pyramid. There's no fucking fire escapes. They design a building with no fucking fire escapes, and then they don't even know for sure the cause of the fire. What the fuck is that?
Okay, now this is interesting because this is one of the things that I'm kind of. I was watching. What was I watching? I think I was watching The Shining, just kind of catching a bit of it because it shows on broadcast, and I always, when things are broadcast, I kind of feel like there's a meaning to it, so I always try to watch a little bit of it, and I started to look. Okay, so you've got this family; they're going to this distant locates. The Shining is the most type of classic slasher type horror film there is. That's what it really is, right? It's like Crystal Lake, you know. Bunch of kids go out into the woods. Mm-hmm. Terrible things happen, right? And then what? This element becomes intellectualized, and not just intellectualized. I don't know what the word I want to use is, but it's like Kubrick is encoding or decoding this particular myth. And I was just sitting watching the beginning of The Shining, and I thought, oh, shit. It was actually the scene where they're all going out in the car. So where they talk about the Donner Party.
Sure.
And I started, it was exactly what Wendy was saying. Oh, isn't this about where the Donner Party? This is what everybody says the very first time they enter the mountains of the Western United States. I wonder how close we are to where the Donner.
Uh-huh.
I know this happens because, like, I'm a mountaineer, right? I've been to these places, and you wouldn't believe how many times it's like that question. Oh yeah, you're from New York. Do you know Tim? It's that silly. I wonder if we're near where the Donner. I've heard this like four or five times in my life from different people. As soon as you're entering in the mountains to the northwest of the United States, so. I realized, wait a second, it's, you know that film that came out recently, Cabin in the Woods?
I haven't seen it.
It's a teen kind of slasher film. It's funny. And basically it's these kids, and there's five of them. They go out to this cabin in the woods. I realized this is what The Shining is. It's a Cabin in the Woods movie. But the thing about Cabin in the Woods is that it is about Cthulhu. It's about the Necronomicon. And I think people at this moment are perceiving something about this in reverse. And that is that we're talking about deliberate sacrifice. This isn't a hint about some kind of supernatural event. Because this is one of the things that is, I think, strongly... Am I echoing too much? Because I can...
No, it's my own computer.
When I start getting talking loud, I get a bit animated. But okay, so here's what I'm trying to say. Up until now, I think that looking at, say, this phenomenon that we're talking about, say, with this apparently sacrificial ritual taking place at the MGM Grand, et cetera, no fire escapes built, 119 people dying, and what is clearly preventing. I mean, like, I remember watching this on TV. It was like 9/11.
Yeah,
people were standing, waving, and jumping out and shit like that, right? They were actually jumping out of their high balconies to their deaths to avoid the heat in some circumstances. So that's it. Having the 9/11 quality there. And I'm not a huge fan of Jake Kotze per se, but he says pyramid, right? Pyramid, pillar, basically being the same thing. So you have – but okay. So the way I feel that this is always – is being looked at mainly is this. Wow, this is incredible. There must be some kind of – like there's some kind of archetypal in the Jungian sense. Or there's some kind of, maybe it's a spiritual model. But this is what I'm thinking right now. I'm thinking that there's already, like, I'm actually believing, quite frankly, that there is a structure of human beings who have known about this for a long time, and they're actually just setting these things up on purpose. Because it's appeasement.
Sure.
That's what it's about. It's about appeasement, basically. These ultra-dimensional gods apparently could threaten to completely destroy our universe at any time, and so all of these weird, like, when we look at it from one direction, from the direction in which we are accustomed to seeing it as a supernatural phenomenon, but, and this is what the movie Cabin in the Woods does, and I would highly recommend you watch it just for a laugh, if nothing else.
Sure.
Particularly the opening sequence is astonishing, because the film is about how this type of Cthulhu thing is understood, and it's known about by all the governments of the world, and each of them have their own little staging areas where they stage these events, and then the events are then mythologized into something else, like, say, the Donner Party, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there a spot somewhere in the Sierras that is an actual sacrificial altar? Is that what we're really talking? I think, see, like, you know, Bill Blakemore or whatever in Family of Man, he talks about, oh yeah, it's an Indian burial ground and it's the spirits of the Indians, but maybe it's the reverse. Maybe Indians also buried their dead there as an appeasement, and it's a continuation of an appeasement process. It seems to be more and more likely to me. I don't know.
Sure, there's the appeasement idea, and then there's also the idea that you're usurping energy, so to speak. So, like, that's with the king kill idea, that's that the
usurping energy or drawing energy?
Well, both. Because with the king kill thing, according to the Golden Bough, they related to it that the power of the king, the life force of the king, is the life force of the empire.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the king dies, that energy gets redistributed. And so it would just get dispersed, but instead they're looking to channel it. And
right.
So the sacrifice in the temple, traditionally in Judaism, you're doing the same you're doing the same principle. So you're literally taking what energy that would just be dispersed into the terrestrial wherever, but
and you're channeling. Okay, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
because that could be like, you know, they take the corpse of King Arthur to Avalon. That could be a kind of a sacrificial altar, and it could also represent something that is a vortex.
Right.
It has the ability of a vortex to draw energy towards it, and therefore over a horizon or over a curve, and that could describe a lot of the phenomena we're talking about, right?
Yeah. Did you catch in the lyrics of Abba where she's talking about the fireplace and the embers of the fireplace?
And she makes
a statement. So she's like, in this cold December, so knowing that the original fire happened in December, we have reason to remember. And then she's talking about that the past and the present are intertwined. And it's like, and she says it all in a row. Like, and like, there's all these examples of things in that fucking album, like, you can just see it. It's so direct.
It's so direct that I, like, and again, this is where, you know, I'm on this line. It's like, is this something that human beings, that any type of guild or, you know, say, you could say Freemasons or whatever, are able to channel with that sort of kind of very directed focus? And what I mean by directed is not just energy, but very particular types of energy to very particular types of places and points in time and things like that. And that's what it's seeming to be, right?
Right.
So, you know, and to me, that is just, it's very, very, have you heard about the red heifer thing?
Yeah, they found the red heifer.
They found it. They bred it.
Oh,
right?
Is that right? I didn't know that part.
This Texan has been working on it for a long, long time. I found out about it back in in the early days of disinformation, and they had those little shows that they were doing. And in one of them, they had a guy talk about the red heifer and how this particular Texas millionaire was trying to breed it, and apparently it has been bred.
Right.
Now, when you take the fact that there's an actual red heifer, and then you take what's going on in Israel exactly right now,
right,
a whole lot of stuff starts to make much more sense.
Totally.
Right? Like, it's clear, okay, are we trying to so, to me, and this is totally millennial too, right? Like, we're moving towards a point here where this particular sequence of, is it 7,000 years, do you think, or is it just the six, going back to Moses?
I don't really know, because I don't know about Babylonian rabbis.
Yeah. Speaking of rabbis, how's your rabbi's book doing?
You know, probably sold about, who knows, 10 copies. I don't know. He expected that. I mean, he didn't expect much. He did it for himself in the first place.
Yeah,
and then I presented to him, hey, I know a publisher. Would you like to publish it? you know. And so those.
I noticed how the cover design of the book is red, white, and black, like the Nazi flag, right?
Right. I don't know if that's necessarily what he. I mean, his.
Oh, really? I wondered if he did.
I don't know. I didn't ask him that, but he'd definitely be quick to admit that the parallels are pretty ridiculous.
Oh, it's pretty hard. Well, you got the Ashkenazis, right? The so-called self-hating or non-religious type of Jews, obviously. Are you Jewish, David?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my mother's side is Jewish. Yeah.
Oh, your mother's Jewish?
Yes.
Yeah, so it comes from the mother's side, so that makes you Jewish.
I'm a German Jew.
Oh, okay. All right.
My father's side is German. Yeah.
But they would call you a Yid.
Yeah, right.
Up in this part of the world where I live, which is, there's no Jews around this corner of the universe.
Right.
It's ironic because we both live in the West, but Western Canada is one of the most ass-backward places on the planet. I mean, it is crazy. It is crazy. You know, it's really weird living here. I was telling Alex today how, like, I just had to endure a visit from a social worker for no other reason than to come and make sure I was keeping my apartment clean enough. I'm like, I'm a regular apartment dweller, right? Every apartment dweller has to put up with this on a regular basis in Canada, where we're basically living in a truly like a socialist regime. And, they had to assess whether or not I would be allowed to live here any longer and stuff like that. And it's just like, you know, it's so strange, this world right now. It's so out of whack, everything. Like, it's really bringing me down. So I'm with you in the kind of...
Yeah, man. I went into a really fucking deep, dark place working on the overlay of Full Metal Jacket, The Shining, and Eyes Wide Shut.
Heavy shit, man.
So,
you see what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
With how, like, there are these wheels that just seem to cut through the image.
Yeah.
Just appear and then disappear. And, of course, you know, in Eyes Wide Shut, you got the Hotel Jason, right? And the idea of the mask in Jason.
Uh-huh.
So maybe the events of I'm wondering now if that they can be pinpointed to a Friday the 13th.
Right. So is that about Freya? Is that the idea? God of Freya?
I'm not actually sure what it's about, but I know that, like he's winking. You know, Kubrick loves fucking movies. That's it.
Right. I go, like, Freya and Jason and the Argonauts. Because there's a connection that exists there because the gold. What is the thing with the Golden Fleece where, also he dies, Jason dies because of what's her name? I'd have to look up the mythology. I went into this a long time ago.
His wife, Medea?
What's that?
It's not his wife that causes his death, is it, Medea?
No. I can't remember. I wrote about it a long time ago.
Okay, well, I'll look into it. But the main thing with Jason is just this whole Friday the 13th like series. He's got the mask, and then he wields this thing. And I don't know if you've done the sync up with Metal and Shining yet.
No, I'm sure it's awesome, though.
It is awesome. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, all of these things are. And I'm not saying you need to run out and do it, but that first line in Metal, one of these days I'm going to cut you up into little pieces. This is very critical to Kubrick. I mean, he talked about the filmmaking process being editing, and I think he's going way, way beyond this, essentially. The question is there a point? Is he actually a sociologist, or is he just one of the most archly intelligent artists who's ever lived?
Right.
I can't figure it out, you know?
Right.
Like, I look at it, when I think about my relationship to Kubrick, I feel like he's a very mean-spirited teacher who continually slaps me upside the head with a book, going, look, this is the terrible world you live in. Stop being such a pussy and go kill, kill, kill. You know, like, that's kind of... sort of what I feel that Kubrick was getting at is the release of something, the destruction of, like, Eyes Wide Shut is so grim. I don't know if you follow the Madeleine McCann story out of Portugal. Madeleine McCann is Helena Harford. There's a real life Helena Harford, and she really does get abducted, and she hasn't been seen. And her mother is a doctor, and her father is an art dealer. And all of a sudden, as soon as their daughter disappears, these ordinary people all of a sudden have a massive connection to the British royal family. And it's astonishing. There's a four-part series up on Vimeo right now about it. And he goes through the case very clearly that these parents participated in the abduction of their child. And it's, you know, I mean... What is going on here, Dave?
Good question. So, you know, what's really weird is that you don't even know this because you didn't finish the video, which is fine. But, you know, when Full Metal Jacket ends, so Eyes Wide Shut and The Shining are very similar lengths. And if you'll see, you can see the timing of the way that one ends, and Eyes Wide Shut keeps going, and it's in the The Shining ends at when they're in the store, so when at the very end of the film with the bear, and I did a thing where when Full Metal Jacket ends, I play Lucifer Rising, and
yeah, I watched that.
Okay, you got there.
Yeah.
So what's weird is that so I did a whole thing with Lucifer Rising and metal, and one of these days I'll chop you up into little pieces with Bobby Beausoleil. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
I know Bobby Beausoleil. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
Bobby Goodson.
But yeah, but the irony of what you're talking about with one of these days I'll chop you up into little pieces with Jack, being the two came together, and I didn't even consider your take on that. So it went there. And if you look at the parallels with Wendy with the knife and then Bobby Beausoleil's knife.
There's also, I don't know how closely you've looked at the lallations in Kubrick. Like correct and collect, that's the big one, right? Maybe they need to be corrected. Well, and then he says, I've got to go collect my family.
Right.
So collect, he's talking about chopping them up, because that's what happens when Grady chops them up and stacks them neatly. That's the collection process, right? Collected into these limbs and made into firewood.
So is that just a Hiram Abiff Osiris thing, or what's
going on? I don't fucking know, man. Right. I was blown away, for instance, when Galen Nuala appear at the exact moment the twins flash for the first time in The Shining. That was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed it even yourself, but the very first time we ever see the twins in The Shining, this is the moment that Gale and Newell come in. So there can't be any doubt about it, what he's doing here.
Oh, so
essentially.
Jude, so this was the other thing. So I didn't realize, okay, the Bishop's Wife, which came out right the day before, on December 7th, 1947, the day before this hotel fire, that's David Niven.
Yes, David Niven, yes.
Who is the Sun King in... Eye of the Devil, Sharon Tate's debut film.
Of course, yes, yeah.
So if you look at the implications there.
I don't know if you're a reader of biographies, but I highly recommend reading David Niven's two books. One of them is called The Moon's a Balloon, interestingly enough. And the other is called Bring on the Empty Horses. Bring on the Empty Horses is his story of his work in Hollywood, and The Moon's a Balloon is the story of his life. This guy is fucking incredible. He fought in World War II as a fighter pilot. He was on the streets like an urchin at the age of 12. He was screwing prostitutes by the time he was 14 years old.
Huh.
Niven. So I haven't read these books in a long time, but now I think about them and the amazing life this guy's had. And this idea, and here's what I'm getting at. If there's something of an invitation in Kubrick, could it be an invitation to a sacrifice? It's like he's saying, okay, here's what you do. This is what's going to happen. You're going to come. We're going to like eat your heart out. But afterwards, you know, you will be resurrected into. Is that a potential here?
Yes.
Because to me, that is really fucking scary.
Yeah, it is. Because it's almost as if everyone's taking part in it and not realizing that they are.
Oh, yes, exactly.
And it could just be the fucking May Day Festival. I mean, Samuel Goldwyn, the G of MGM, his birthday is May 1st. He's born on fucking Beltane.
That's
the fucking Burning Man goddamn ritual. Oh. You're burning the fucking hotel. You burn another hotel. It's a goddamn pyramid with no fire escapes. What the fuck, dude? What the fuck? The Visitor comes out the same day as the MGM building burning
down.
That is
extraordinary. It is absolutely unbelievable.
It's totally unbelievable.
It is.
And then the building's in the goddamn fucking scene. From the biggest fire that happened in a hotel in the fucking country, it's in one of the opening shots of the fucking movie.
Right.
I gasped. I literally gasped when I came across everything. There was one point where I was like, because I just couldn't fucking believe it. I'm like, really? Yeah. And like, that reminds me of the Kubrick quote where he said, like, I have it on my website where he says, you know, the thrill of it is when you figure it out for yourself and it gets through to the heart, because it's the joy of discovery that pierces you.
But also there's this element of seduction, and the added element that I feel about this is there a level of intelligence where there's the point where each of us is being asked who, and when I say each of us, I'm talking about right now, people like you and me and people who are really trying to push their heads through this stuff, because quite frankly to me, it's dangerous and it feels scary and all that other, like, it's terrifying, man.
Yeah.
I'm like, what the fuck, what is this world that we're living in at all? It's like, it's literally Hellraiser almost to a certain extent. It's like, yes, you know, you're going to become a Cenobite or something like that. But, and this is where the seductive property comes in. Like, I just can't get around it, you know? Something about it feels wrong. And this is when the scared little child in me wants Jesus to come and save me, basically.
Yeah.
And just, please send me the Good Shepherd already, you know, because I can't fucking deal with this crap anymore. That's kind of where I've been for almost this last year, you know, since I kind of wrapped up my work at the Wrong Way Wizard, because I haven't done anything there in a long time. It's just like, what the fuck is going on? And what am I supposed to do about it?
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do about this, David? What are we supposed to do about it? If anything, I mean,
I feel like those three films, Full Metal Jacket, Eyes Wide Shut, and The Shining, all focus on neurosis and psychoanalysis. And it's in one mind, and I think it's fucking his mind. And that's the whole, that, and he's like...
I don't know about that, because there are scenes, for instance, let me give you an example, say Full Metal Jacket. There's a lot of fucking NLP in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Oh, yeah. Like, for instance, the suicide scene where Gomer or where Private Pal kills. This is this could be about homosexuality, right? Like, Private Joker says, go easy, bro. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what this is like. I'm just guessing, but I have a feeling that one man is like, hey, you know, that's not the same size hole as you usually go into, so do it more gently. And then, of course, he's sitting on a toilet. And then this idea of crossing Deoth, which is, of course, Uranus or Uranus, and then the idea of anal sexual rituals being all over Crowley, like all of this stuff starts to glom together to me. Like, what is being said here? Is this something where you're supposed to go out and, you know, do some kind of sex ritual almost? And God knows, you know and I know that there's people out there who are doing it. I suspect you might be some of the time doing, like, you're saying, hey, you know, let's give this a try. Because that's kind of how I see you, as like sort of an adventurer, whereas I'm more of a librarian type. But, you know, there's that.
No, it doesn't appeal to me. I was with a girl one time who kept on trying to stick her finger up my ass, and it ended our whole thing. Like,
I'm not
like,
talking about anal behavior or anything. I'm talking about whether or not there's, like, not whether it appeals to you personally, but whether or not there's an actual I feel there's a very strong code in Kubrick that has to do with the asshole. So either it's Freudian.
Uh-huh, which it probably is. Cause
but then there's this element of ritual that is added into it as well.
Oh, sure. Well, sex is a ritual.
This is something that I'm starting to think. You know what Nabokov called Freud, right?
Nabokov? Is that the guy who wrote Lolita?
Yes, that's right. Okay. Yeah, Nabokov.
What did he call?
Well, he said that, you know, the term therapist is the rapist.
Right.
Right? And so this is kind of what I'm thinking, is that I'm starting to get this sensation that there is an element of rape into highly penetrative analysis of individuals and their motivations, right? And it almost like, when I think of Freud, and I feel like Kubrick would agree with this completely, like I can say that, we're talking about Moses, right? And then when we think about Jung, we're either looking at David or the seed of David, who is Christ, right? The heroic figure. And of course, that fits in completely with who Jung is, Carl Jung, the child, the young one. And then, you know, the joy is what Freud means.
Right? I love it. Well said. Yeah, no, I feel
yeah, that's
you.
Jupiter, the planet. So they are Jupiter and Apollo. They were literally. And so if you start to think about, okay, and this also fits in with the more conspiracy-minded qualities of this, because you know that it was his nephew Bernays, Freud's nephew, mm-hmm. that established a lot of mind fucking techniques.
Oh yeah,
I would be willing to bet that Bernays and what he learned is fundamentally MK Ultra ready. For instance, I wish we could sit down and watch a movie together sometime and just like pause a scene and like I could say, okay, here's what I see, because like for instance, Iron Man 3. Right? This is another film that is all about repressed, like Pepper Potts is the anus, essentially. Right.
Well, this is the idea that the sublimation turns violent.
Yeah.
I would say that I'm actually in my hands right now. I'm holding an interview with Jim Morrison and Lizzie James. I don't know if I'm going to read it. I'm not finding the excerpt I'm looking for.
I totally get what you're meaning.
He talks about where does the fascination with violence come from? And it's the aggression that when natural instincts are being denied.
Sublimated, absolutely. So you want to do something, whatever it might be. Yeah. And then you don't feel you can do it because there's social strictures of one kind or another, or just neurosis, then this turns into violent behavior. Yeah, absolutely. Like, go ahead.
Well, it's just, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you're aware of this, but the Vanity Fair article on Kubrick, where he literally, the guy who's writing the article is talking about how Kubrick called him up and was like, I want to do a movie about Carl Jung's idea of the shadow. Are you familiar with this concept? And he's like, do you know of any good war books? Like, and that's where that came from. And that's why when you're watching it, you don't, you know, and I mean, obviously, you're kind of slight nemesis, fucking what's his name, who presents this concept, the English.
Rob Adger?
Yeah, Rob Adger.
He's not really my nemesis.
I know. but, you know, he presents this idea and he gives a strong case for it, and I don't agree with it everywhere it goes. But, that's the thing, is that doesn't take much because he fucking said it himself.
And he's a Kubrick fanboy.
Oh, yeah.
Ultimately, Rob Adger. That's what he is. He's like, I would like to sit and have coffee with Kubrick, and we would talk as equals about, give me a fucking break. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at what you just put together.
Right.
Are you serious?
Right.
Like, literally, are you serious? I mean,
right.
Do this. It doesn't even seem possible. And everything starts to make sense, too, in terms of the idea that why his films took so long to make. I mean, and why he took these shots. You know, the whole thing about why would he, you know, Scatman Crothers, what do you want from me, Mr. Kubrick? You know, after taking 115 takes of him going, So, you know, what he's doing, he's getting the bears, right? He's getting the lighting. He's waiting until that moment when the head tips in just the right way, that the shadow and the light and the contrast create this quadruplicate of images that just go on forever. And of course, he can't tell people this because they'd never understand it, right? You know, in Kubrick's films, actors are models. That's it. That's all they are. They're just models. People he's posing around to get the exact, and it's so arch. It is so arch. So how could a human being be like this? You know, and so this is where I differ from people like Rob Adger. I'm comfortable learning as much as I can from these guys. And like I said about his whole European Union Clockwork Orange thing is dead on the money.
Totally.
Yeah, it's so scary how dead on. And you talked about the Ojo. I can't tell you how many people I have, like, I don't know what your most popular of your mashups are. But the Clockwork Orange with the two... man, that has been so revealing to me.
Super Tramp, Crime of the Century.
Mind numbing.
Yeah, so they took that one down, actually.
What's that?
They took that one down, actually.
The thing of it is, I know how it all starts up. I actually did it with my own stereo and my own copy of Clockwork Orange because I wanted to get a better quality sound. And that was extremely revealing, as I'm sure you know. You would know better because you actually mixed it yourself. But I
must have played those two albums. Yeah, I went over and over and over that, and I wasn't even, like, my mindset, what I was looking for, because my scope on my rationale, this sounds insane, but I didn't even notice that I'm listening to the same fucking song. It sounds insane, because I'm doing it on mute as I'm doing it, because I'm trying to align it with the visuals, and I wasn't thinking about the fact that I'm listening to that weird version of the Ninth Symphony in both fucking scenes.
They replay
as a song. I edited it together and then I'm like, wait a minute.
I'm going to tell you a little story, just on a personal note, how deeply that thing touched me. Because I used to have this fantasy when I was a kid of like renting a Maserati and driving it from Edmonton, which is the city in the north where I live, to Calgary here. I lived in Edmonton as a kid, so I used to think, I have a Maserati, man, I just ripped down the highway. And my idea was that I would do it to Breakfast in America, right? And are you still there?
Yeah, I'm just...
Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm losing you here.
Okay, I'm having difficulty. I'm taking off the video.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So I don't know if you heard what I just said, but I used to dream about driving a car, basically, really fast to Breakfast in America. And I remember in my fantasy, I would, like, put the car into gear at the exact moment that I'd Gone Hollywood started. And, of course, where you start Gone Hollywood, it's a tank plowing through a field, right?
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, oh, holy fuck, man. This is like, wow. It even has the same, like, the feeling that I get from listening to that song is something that you picked up on innately. Like, that idea of how it seems to run down a road somehow, you know?
Uh-huh.
But I think my favorite part of that, I don't know if you noticed this, but in the scene where his reprogramming is taking place on stage, and he's being put through his paces, when the song is the Logical song, right? It's playing, and it's where Roger Hodgson is just squealing, "Who I am, who I am," you know that?
Uh-huh.
That lyric. It's right when that the beautiful topless naked girl comes up, and I realize at this instant how deadly you nailed this. It was that point when I knew, man, this is dead on the money. Because Alex is looking at himself. That's what that scene is about. This is the way he has treated women, right? He stands on their faces, he takes advantage of them, and then he leaves them, right? And just walks away from them. And in the book, you know, that scene where he has the sex with the two girls in his room, that is portrayed as a rape sequence in the book. So I'm looking at him going, oh, yeah, this is a Baphomet thing, right? This is who Alex is. He's Baphomet. And you're that scene with the Who I Am proves it. It's like Alex is the one screaming the Logical song. He's saying, what is up with all these stupid rules? Can you tell me who I am, who I am? And then he looks and he sees who he really is. He is a non-sexual super being of some kind, like some kind of alien.
Well, every time I watch that scene, I see it that he's a child. We're not little children, are we, Alex? And like I watch the way, I mean, there's no fucking erection. And he's with these women and he's kind of playing around. It's like he doesn't know what he's doing. It's like,
yes.
It's a little kid. It's like, it seems to be like a statement on the amorphous perversity of Freud.
Yes, absolutely. Exactly. Exactly. Whether, what, exactly. Oh, yeah, you nailed it. See, I saw it in terms of the teleology of a Baphomet emerging as a, because, you know, Alex representing the unified principle in that, the letter A on the poster for Clockwork Orange, you know, and they're putting up these towers, these single monolithic towers all over the world. And the one in London is called the London Shard, right?
Yeah, the Dark Crystal.
It's funny because I never get any points with my psychiatrist. I've been seeing my psychiatrist for 12 years now. You could say he's like my rabbi, but it's kind of in reverse because I do all the talking.
Yeah, I just called today to see about getting a new psychiatrist.
Mm, you have a psychiatrist?
I did, and she was driving me fucking nuts because she would talk over me. Who the fuck, like, come on. Like, I don't need the full psychoanalysis where I'm laying on the thing, staring at the ceiling. Like, I don't need that. But I don't need somebody who's just like, I'm communicating something that's, like, super fucking deep for me, and then she's, like trying to butt in to give her opinion. Mm-hmm. It's like, no.
Yeah, so, my psychiatrist never does that.
I have enough people in my life that fucking do that, you know? And, like, and I understand from them. But, like, the role of a psychiatrist? Uh-uh. Fucked up.
That's funny. Right. Well, see, I see my relationship with my I'm sorry.
It's okay.
My relationship with my psychiatrist, I say this to him when I see him, is like, I just want to see if I can get any kind of reaction out of it. So I talk with him about the kind of stuff that we talk about, right? And I got him last time, which is just a couple of weeks ago, and I said, you know, the London Shard. I said, all that is the poster from A Clockwork Orange. It's the same thing. It even has a little bit like that top one shard breaks out a little bit from the end. I don't know if you've seen the image or not, but
sure.
It's basically a three-dimensional version of the famous Clockwork Orange poster. So, you know, and he actually went, oh, yeah, you're right. So that was kind of neat. Maybe there is hope for these principles to become maybe a little bit more widely understood. Maybe, and that might be the point where, I don't know, we might be able to see something happen or have, because this is the thing that really brings me down, right? It's like I write articles and sometimes I feel good about them you know, say with Moon in the Middle or with Suicide Switch that I did after that, I actually, they felt like they were cracking open something in my mind, right?
Right.
When I was coming up with this stuff. But then, it's like, where, what do I do with it? You know, this is why I become frustrated.
Right.
Is because what am I supposed to do? Am I just supposed to become an artist? Is that the process? Right? Where, you know, you have enough of a framework now that you can describe the universe, so you might as well put it to work creating something quasi-fictional or quasi, like, say, for strictly artistic purposes. I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question, man.
And a part of me feels like that's the so-called Hotel California or, you know, the Gold Room thing. It's like, you know, we all just put on our costumes, we get dressed for dinner, and we go, it doesn't mean anything, but we're all putting on a really fine show, essentially.
Yeah, and perfect isolation hid behind my wall, though.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is that you're, like, alone with the fucking shit. Even if you communicate it and somebody hears what you're saying, it's still like you're alone with it. It's like the Donnie Darko, you always die alone.
Yeah, that's I find this to be very difficult to deal with myself. I mean, you know, I don't want to say, like I would, I'm not a suicidal person by my nature.
Good.
But, so that kind of thing I wouldn't do. But
well, I'd hate to fucking lose you, man.
I appreciate that. That means so much to me. You know, it's hilarious because like when I looked at the dream book from Mark LeClaire thing yesterday, it just brought me down so much. I thought I can't live up to this. You know, I can't live up to somebody who says, hey, you know, I'm going to, look at, put this together and maybe.
No, man, all that was is that the
whole time. Well, I know it's your own idea.
No, that the whole time I'm fucking doing it, I'm thinking of you. And I'm thinking about your work, and I'm thinking about what you're doing, and I'm just like, I wanted to dedicate it to you, and then I was like, I don't have a place to dedicate this where it'll be seen, so I fucking just put it in the title.
Yeah, a major prize. I can't tell you how much that means. I can't tell you what that means to me, you know, to have you as a friend. It's just amazing.
I went fucking deep with that one, man. I was up for 2 days straight. Like, and I was, like,
It blew me the fuck away. My mom was watching it. And she's like, I can't look at this. It's too scary.
She's
watched My Eyes Wide Shut and The Wall sync up with me. She loved it. So, but, you know, that kind of thing she doesn't do. But even she was like, wow, this is something. It is, it's just extraordinary. But, like, right now, I gotta admit, I'm just scared, basically. You know, I feel like, can I live up to whatever the universe wants from me? And for this last little while, I just don't feel like I can. I just, you know, like, and that's why I've been hiding for so long. You know, I mean, I come up with ideas of something that I think I might do, and then I don't do it because. But now I feel charged up again. This is the best I felt in maybe. Well, no, because I mean, you're kind of a squirrely dude. You're hard to read, and I mean, I like you immensely, quite frankly. I've loved our discussions, and I just like you. And with a guy like you, who's like so, you know, I guess almost avant-garde in a certain kind of way, I always wonder, I always worry that I'm just going to be regarded as some kind of, you know, fatuous old square, basically. But so it's really cool to have your friendship, and I appreciate that a lot.
The thing I appreciate about what you do is I don't believe everything you say.
Well, of course not.
But I feel like I don't believe everything I think. And I come to this place where I'm like, it's in the opening, it's in the reception, it's in, like, you know, when you do tefillin, you're the whole fucking point is to receive, like, to put yourself aside to get the information, and it's just being open, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's cracking my head open, you know.
Yeah.
And
well,
it's like, well, where it goes,
that's part of what it is.
But then shit comes out, like the fucking visitor thing. Like, it's because I was like, you know, just like, what is it? It's something. What the fuck is it? And then there it is. And I'm just that's what it fucking is.
Well, listen, I want to tell you this because I read about your visitor sync last night. But I didn't want to do it. I think it was last night, wasn't it?
I mean, I just.
Did you post that yesterday?
Yesterday, I think, yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe it was today, but the point of the matter is that it's okay. Here's the thing. I don't even know whether I read about it last night or tonight. Yeah. I think I read about it last night, but I decided that, you know, it was too late. I wanted to go up to my room, and I don't have a stereo or a computer up there. But I do have a TV, and I was watching this movie, The Terminal Man.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Michael Crichton, yeah.
Have you seen the film?
A long time ago.
Well, here's the thing. The first image in this movie is a centered kind of quasi-close-up on a helicopter. And this is it's the exact same perspective as on the ABBA album called The Arrival, right? Mm. So last night I was watching Terminal Man for the first time in, like, I don't know, maybe since the 80s. And it's rife with references to AI. It's basically not about what it appears to be about at all. And there's all sorts of 2001 stuff in there, too.
I'm ready to overlay it with the Andromeda Strain, but go on.
Well, yeah, yeah, but here's the thing. I want to overlay it with the Arrival.
Okay.
The album, because the terminal, right? The terminal is the last space. It's where you get when you arrive.
Right, all at the same time. Bring in the Andromeda Strain. Fuck it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I want to ask you at some point, not today, but I'm interested in trying to do some of this stuff myself. What software and kind of stuff do you use to do it?
I use Adobe Premiere.
Adobe Premiere. Okay, so I'd have to go out and shell it a few $100.
I got it from a friend who bought it.
But how much is it on the market?
It's pretty expensive.
Okay.
You can get a cracked copy of it. I had a cracked copy of it, and it worked better than the one that I ended up getting that was the real one. So who knows? But yeah, it's a pain in the ass. But it's worth it sometimes.
And another thing I want to mention to you is, so I told you that I talked to Alex Fulton today. Well, he's blown away by this stuff that you've come up with on The Visitor. And he wants to sit down and have a chat, like a three-way talk with you and me about it.
Cool.
So I don't know if you wanted to just do that at some point, and maybe we could put it up, or I don't know if in the next time some always record slot comes up or something.
Sure, too, sure. And at that point, you know, you can have seen it all the way through. And because it stays like that, and it only gets better. And those are the best syncs. The one that's at every run through, it gets even more on point.
Well, I can't wait. I'm gonna do it as soon as I get off the phone with you.
Groovy.
Yeah. So
yeah.
I'm free. Basically, I got nothing to do tonight. So
cool. I didn't know that the album would be so good in the first place. It's a good album.
Yeah, it is a good album. It is a good album. Yeah. I'm saying it's their least poppy kind of album. Mm-hmm. But Arrival is a very dark, so I'm interested in doing this sync up with Arrival and the Terminal Man too. So I'm just putting a bee in your bonnet on that one.
Cool. Well, I would really like it if you fucking were putting videos up. If you were putting videos up, I'd watch everyone as soon as it came up.
Sweet. All right. Well, because I'm, you know, you're blowing me away with this stuff. So I'm, you've kind of, maybe this is what I need to do, because like I need to take some kind of step in my life. It's been a long time that I've been just kind of waiting for a sign of something. I wouldn't even say it's a sign, because I don't really believe in that kind of thing, because it's a bit too easy, you know? Like, I think you have to make choices, right? And that's where things get interesting. But I'm fascinated by this, so I really want to give this a go. But anyway, I don't know. Are you hearing me right now?
Watching this thing with these three films and Lucifer Rising, and I'm just like, I'm looking at Bill and I'm seeing Jack inside of him, crawling out of his fucking skin, like just completely, like, you know, like I just, it's it felt, and then the war side of it, violence extending from sublimation over and over and over again.
Yes, that's a big head. So, you know, have you seen the film Seconds? The Rock Hudson movie?
I have not.
Okay, listen, I don't know what you're doing. Like, you know, you got this. This is, I'm not saying this lightly, all right? Because you need to see this movie, because it has all sorts of Eyes Wide Shut cues in it, including a password, Fidelio.
Oh, yeah.
And it also has an orgy sequence and everything else. And it gives away major, major clues about the issues about Eyes Wide Shut in terms of it being some kind of therapy. It's like you're a human being, you're repressed, and it's almost like it's a threat. If you can't deal with your repressions and put them into an area where they are represented actually, where the actions are represented by the thoughts that you're repressing, then you're going to end up in some kind of serious trouble.
Right. Basically. Totally. Yeah, my art is my only saving grace. It's spiraling out of control.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing that it's doing that.
No, no, no. Well, see, this film Seconds, I'll just tell you very briefly to give you the plot idea. It's about this fellow who is just unsatisfied with his life. He's just like an average schlub guy. He's an insurance salesman or something. And I'm just going to send you a like IMDb link to it. So, and what he does is he just, he finds out about this organization that gives you a totally new life, right? And when they do it, he becomes a painter, interestingly enough. That's kind of how I think of you when I think of your art.
Uh-huh.
I know that you're way broader than that because your visual art is so stunning. I often think of you as a painter. But anyway, in this film, so he decides he wants to live, he wants to be a painter, an artist. And so he goes and they give him this second life. That's where Seconds comes from. But the clue about in terms
of... Oh, yeah, I do know about this only because of that, what's his name, the ideology... Perver's Guide to Ideology. Isn't that the film that he's looking at one point?
Yes, yes, he does. Yeah, there's a brief second of that in there. Yeah.
Okay.
Check this movie out if you can, David. It'll blow you away.
Yeah, I'm kind of scared of it because it's probably going to hit home too much. But that's okay.
It might, because it's definitely about, like, you know, whether or not you accept your life and whether or not you're capable of it. And it's also about this idea, and I think this is an important idea, that if you are truly given a second chance to be something that is more fitting of your dreams than of the person you actually are, will you be able to live up to it?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. So here's Jim Morrison talking to Lizzie James. He says, there are different types of freedom. There's a lot of misunderstanding. The most important kind of freedom is to be what you really are. You trade your reality for a role. You trade your senses for an act. You give up your ability to feel and in exchange put on a mask. There can't be any large-scale revolution until there's a personal revolution on an individual scale. It's going to happen inside first. You can take away a man's political freedom and you won't hurt him unless you take away his freedom to feel. Then you can destroy him.
Mm. Okay, that is to me, I totally agree with that. Like, you know, the so-called Cartesian, I think, therefore I am?
Yeah.
Right? Like, is that actually accurate? And I'm trying to think, what is the real thing? I blank, therefore I am. And I think it's feel.
Well, that's kind of Hume.
Hume? Okay, I'm not familiar with Hume.
Hume's whole thing was that you're a feeling being.
Yes.
And that was how he stood in contrast to Descartes, yeah.
David Hume, okay. It is David Hume, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with his actual writing, but yeah, to me that makes sense. Because, I mean, when you feel good or bad, you know it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's so deep you can't, and this is one of the, and this is another reason I'll say between you and me and a few different lampposts, but not many others, is that I sort of feel like what I feel about this kind of these types of media realities, it's very dark, and I like this is one of the things, you know, for the last 2 weeks I haven't really wanted to talk to anybody at all, and when I say that I literally mean that I have talked to no one except for my mom. And I haven't left my house at all. It's not that I'm afraid to. It's just like sometimes for me, so I'm laying a trip on you here before we say goodbye briefly.
That's fine, yeah.
Sometimes, like what this is for me is it gets to a point where it's like, what good could I pop? It's not like I don't have something to say, right? It's not like I don't have an expression that I feel might even be worthwhile for me. But what good is it going to be for other people? And I kind of have this nice guy sort of complex, right? I over-associate with St. Francis of Assisi. Who deeply made a major impression on me when I was a young kid. But it's this idea that, like, what good am I going to bring to the world by expressing how I really feel about things? Is there something I have to say that could, like, make somebody's life more worth living? And a second point to that first one is, should I pursue it if there is? Right?
Yeah.
What level of responsibility do I have? These fucking things drive me nuts, David. So that's my world.
You know? Right. No, me too, man. I'm going fucking crazy, but that's okay. I'm cracking up.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and whatever. It's what it is, but it's like I'm taking the fucking snakes that are like lodged in my body and I'm like tugging at them and they're like turning around and fucking hissing at me. There's your stridulum. But like, it's like I they're there and it's like the best that I can do is like fucking go in there and like try and like bring them up to the fucking light because I don't know what to do other than that.
That seems like, to be the only thing that, like, that does, but I wonder, see, from the intellectual standpoint, I have to think about the reflexive, because what you're saying makes total sense. But for me, and this is what makes this so tough, a so-called catch-22, in fact, is that I have to wonder to myself, well, maybe that's what they want me to do.
Right.
Maybe it would be better if I just pounded them into darkness and went out and, you know, grabbed a couple of beers and picked up some chick or whatever people do. I mean,
I don't know what they do.
You know, just off in an alleyway and do some pointless vandalism. Because I feel like doing those things sometimes. Like I'm sitting around thinking, damn, would I like to just go and fucking key a few hundred cars? But right. I never do things like that.
Right.
Like because I'm a so-called nice guy, right?
Right. Well, what would be the point of that then? You know, really? What would that do for you? Is that what you're sublimating?
That's a violent action, right?
I think we're sublimating our love. Like, that's
yes, I agree.
The whole
point. I don't think I can handle my love. I don't think I can. It hurts too much, man.
That's the thing, dude. It's fucking painful. Love fucking hurts, dude.
It is painful. See, you're right. This is what it's all about. I don't really want to go out and key cars. It's just that I have this thing inside of me that is so powerful that I don't really feel like I can express it without totally destroying myself.
Right. Yeah, I can relate.
Where does the human being, and I use the metaphor of Christ personally to look at this, right? Just because I'm familiar with it. I'm not saying that it has any actual, the terminology is necessary. But in an algebraic sense, I look at it and I go, I mean, what else is there to do in this life than become a recidivist, to sink into the animus, or to march towards some self-sacrificial, and I ultimately mean non-heroic.
Right.
Sense, right? Because the hero trip is, I think, a bit of a sidestep, right? The real Christ, and this is one of the things that you can see in the kind of media that we study, the real Christ is somebody who's constantly being put through paces and seen as a failure. And it actually kind of makes sense. Like, hey, Christ, what's your problem? You know?
Oh, yeah. No, that's the distinction between a martyr and, like, because a martyr is somebody who's, like, they set out to die for their cause.
Yeah.
Like that Mahatma Gandhi was not a martyr. Martin Luther King was not a martyr. Like
right.
These people weren't martyrs because they were like, I'm going to do what I feel is right. And if I happen to die in the process, then so be it.
Where I have to die in the process. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you're going to die anyway. So why not fucking die doing what you feel is right?
Yeah, well,
I guess.
That's another mystery. Don't even get me started on death. I don't think we have time to talk about that right
now. Right. Death, old friend. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where is thy sting is more what I say. Yeah. Like, seriously, come on, death. Like, what's the fucking, you know, my door is open any old time.
Right.
Come in, by hatch, because I really don't think that, and I think this is one of the mysteries of the tarot as to why death is not numerical. You know, there's actually a phrase in the Bible, I don't know where it is, but it said that death is the same as a hair being pulled out of a pitcher of milk. And in a sense, that's how I feel about it. It's like you couldn't even possibly be aware of it. Your own death is not something you could ever experience, in my opinion. So,
right.
I was just looking at the poster there that I just sent you to, and it's a black cube for seconds. It's a fucking Kaaba cube. Unbelievable, man. These people are all over this shit. In the Facebook thing I just sent you.
Oh, in Facebook. Okay.
Yeah, the poster for seconds is an actual Kaaba.
Oh, really? Oh, wow, that is a Kaaba. Wow, hold on.
Unbelievable.
Wow, no shit. What else would that be?
Yeah, that's right. That's what it is. And, of course, seconds, that's a Saturn thing, right?
Yeah.
Because Saturn is the second principle after Friday, the first principle. After red comes orange. Orange is a clockwork orange, the clock of Saturn. And seconds, of course. Did you ever wonder, like, why are they called seconds, eh? You know, it doesn't make any sense. Second to what? You know? But anyway, listen, you know, do you know that guy for a group name for Grape Juice?
Yes.
Yeah, well, he's actually pestering me to talk right now.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to let you go for a little bit. Boy, this has been quite a day for me. I mean, I haven't talked to anybody in weeks, and now I'm talking to three people in one day.
Okay.
But I hope you realize this isn't just – I'm not just saying this. I'm concerned about you, and I hope you're okay.
Do you want to add him to this call, or
– he said he wanted to – well, you know what? I'd love to.
Okay.
Have you ever talked to him before?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, listen, I'll send it. I'm just going to send him a message right now. He said he'd be a few minutes.
Okay.
So then we can keep chatting.
Cool.
And so he said he was just going to eat his breakfast because he lives in Japan.
Yeah.
So he'll probably be another half an hour.
Yeah. I got on a whole kick with a Funeral Parade of Roses at Alan's suggestion and the Beatles Magical Mystery Tour and Her Majesty's Satanic Request, the Rolling Stones, with that film.
How the fuck do you do this, man?
I would have it up if it wasn't for the subtitle factor, because I can't,
right.
In order to put the subtitles up, I'd have to type them all out and do it frame by, like, section by section myself.
Oh, that's a shitload of work.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of work. But and there's other subtitle films that I also want to do that are kind of, like, that one is, as good as it is, it's actually still in the back burner because of that. But
you know, I never did get through Funeral Parade of Roses. I got distracted at that time because everybody was kind of talking about it, and I was looking at something else myself. But I should watch that tonight too. Well, I'm not going to get off with you guys in time to see both of them.
Nah.
I'm definitely going to watch the Visitor thing from beginning to end.
Cool. Yeah.
Get off our call.
Mindfuck City. For real.
Yeah, I believe you. Yeah. So, have you seen anything new lately? Have you read any good books, or what's up?
Yeah, I've just been into Jung's Man and His Symbols.
Oh, okay. All right.
And you know the thing with that, with Poltergeist?
Well, not exactly, no.
Not just that. Okay, so if you're looking
at... Because the Red Book is in there, right? The Red Book is in Poltergeist.
The Red Book is in The Shining on Ullman's desk.
Right.
But then if you look at the fact that Ullman, the actor who plays Ullman, he's in Poltergeist on the TV while the mother is reading Jung's Man and His Symbols.
That's right. Yes, 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 yes. And what is the film? Oh,
you know what it is, maybe.
I'm sure I know what it is.
Patrick Speck, I think.
I've seen every film that Barry Nelson has made.
Mm.
And I think it might be his James Bond movie.
Yeah, it looked like they were like a World War II kind of thing, maybe.
So. Yeah, yeah, I think it's his Bond film.
Hmm.
I don't know if you knew that he was a Bond.
Really? Because you know that, dude. Do you know about the Spy Who Loved Me? About you know the thing with that? Like it came out on 7/7/77.
No, I didn't know
that. And that the same day that came out, Styx, the band Styx, came out with The Grand Illusion.
Unbelievable!
And that's an awesome fucking pairing.
I will have to check that one out. I'm actually kind of a fan of Styx. Because of back in the day, you know, they were popular when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then
you know the John Dee thing. But then, as I recall, there was a thing in there where I was watching James Bond in The Spy Who Loved Me going down a river in a boat, and he actually gives the coin to the ferryman.
Right.
River Styx. It was like...
Yeah, cheesy. Oh, fuck.
Yeah, John Dee, man.
So... Yeah, like a part of what I'm feeling right now is like there's a, you know, when I was talking to Alex, I was talking about this kind of a suck machine, basically. Like, because one of the things that is, why is it? Well, first of all, two things. The first thing is, why is it that these repeating patterns, which are so, like, they get to a point where they're in your face, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely.
So, okay, so my first question would be, if there are these patterns that are repeating that are so in your face, why is it that we don't notice them more quickly or more easily, A? And then B, why is it that when we do, and this is what's really exciting, why don't they lose their cachet? Why don't they lose their glimmer? Like, it's almost as if the ability of this pattern to repeat itself is more astonishing than anything else could be. It's almost like it's a perpetual motion machine. Because you could see, like, why aren't we bored shitless by this stuff instead of excited?
Uh-huh.
It doesn't make any sense, because all it is a tap-de-tap-tap-tap, tap-de-tap-tap-tap, right?
Right.
So, like, when you get to the level that somebody, like, say, and I'll use, like, you know, a real expert, like, say, somebody like Goro Adachi. I'm not a big fan of his work, but, I mean, he's the kind of guy who he looks at every single date, and he's always constantly, and in a sense, you and I are doing the same thing. I think we do it from the more expressive end. Right? Because for me, this is about expression as much as it is anything else.
Right.
I'm not necessarily trying to prove things to people. I just think that there's something extraordinary to be expressed here. But no matter what, it's like every detail keeps being added. It's like, yeah, it's the same pattern. Here it is. Why is it that we're not just like, fuck?
Yeah.
Like, why don't we rattle our cages
here,
instead?
You'll like this. I start the visitor on the 42nd second mark.
Mm. That's right. I read that in one of your comments.
Yeah, what?
Yep.
And that's, like, that wasn't, I didn't set it to that mark myself. I looked at the timing of the film, and then I looked back afterwards, and it's the 42nd mark.
That's exactly
42nd second mark.
That's what happened to me with my first timing of 2001 with Dark Side of the Moon, which is extraordinary. To me, it's still the killer of all killers.
The 42nd mark?
No, it was actually 420.
Okay.
It's actually, believe it or not, 423, right?
Okay.
Like, you start Dark Side of the Moon on all play repeat 423 into the standard video release or DVD release.
That was the first one you ever did, because you couldn't find The Wizard of Oz.
You know what, since we're talking here, all right, you know, maybe you'd like to hear the whole story behind this.
I remember hearing it on 42 Minutes.
No, I didn't tell the whole story.
Okay, sure.
Because, quite frankly, it's too weird. And the thing of it is, I didn't want to go into that territory, but, I mean, I feel like we're kind of connecting as friends here, so if you're interested, I'll fill you in.
Cool.
It's not lengthy. It's not a lengthy story. I mean, it's a... So basically, what happened was, you can look at this place if you have Google Earth. It's called Beaver Creek, the Yukon. And there's actually a toroidal theater there. It's a theater that's like a donut theater. And that's where the show was put on. You can see it in the aerial photographs when you look at it. This town is on the border of the Yukon and Alaska. And there is no one there. And, of course, during the summer season when they're running their tours up there, their bus tours, which are part of the Holland America Cruise Lines, the Holland part, I think, is even Holland America. It's like I get Hal out of that somehow. I know that might be pushing it a bit, but anyway. So what happened was, this was my third year doing this show up there. And like they run their cruise lines from Seattle up to Anchorage, Alaska, or to Juneau. And then what they do is they put people on buses and they take them on a land tour of the Yukon and Alaska, right? To see wildlife and shit like that. And it's a two-day bus tour. And right in the middle of this two-day bus tour is this town in the middle of nowhere called Beaver Creek. And it is literally in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's a four-hour drive to the nearest gas station in either direction. That's how far away it is. So you got to have a full tank when you. And the only reason that Beaver Creek is there is for exactly this reason, so that people can fill up their tanks on their way from Fairbanks to Whitehorse. And there's an airport at Whitehorse where that Holland America flies their customers out from.
I wouldn't mind being down Beaver Creek without a paddle. I'll tell you that. Okay.
Down, man.
Where we're going, we don't need paddles. Okay.
You don't need no sticking paddles. Well, that's interesting. There's a lot of scissoring going on. Put it that way. But you know, that reminds me of something. I'm going to say this right now while I remember it, because this will be right up your alley. In terms of Crowley, right? I don't know how long it was ago. I was reading the sex book of India, the
Tantra Yoga.
Yeah. No, it's the one where the
Kama Sutra.
The Kama Sutra, right? where they name all the different sex positions and shit like that?
Sure.
Well, guess what the 69 position, when you're laying on your side.
Uh-huh.
Between a man and a woman, on their sides, the 69 position is called the Congress of the Crow.
Really now?
I fuck you not, man. I shit you not. Does that not blow you away? And of course, you know, you have it in the Book of Lies, right? Number 69.
Hey, you know what, man? I've always been a word man, better than a bird man.
You kill me. That's actually funny because I have been thinking about if you could memorize every piece of dialogue that's delivered in a Kubrick film, that all you would ever say would have to be something from that. I've been thinking about doing that. But anyway, so back to my whole story about Beaver Creek. So I'm up in Beaver Creek and I'm playing piano in this show. And the show itself is The Wizard of Oz, right? It's just compacted into an hour and a half long show with only two actors in it. And I was actually the third actor because I was on stage during the whole show playing the piano. And I had a couple of lines in the show as well. They actually called me, believe it or not, the name of my role was the Night Watchman.
Hey, right? Were you blindfolded?
Very funny. Very funny. Well, because I was called the Night Watchman, right? And I always stayed up all night long when I was up there. I was the only one that did it. There was like 100 staff at this hotel. And I was the only one who ever stayed up all night long in the land of the midnight sun. It was really weird. I had a repulsive tendency of people. I made them want to go to bed. But anyway, so this is what happened. And first of all, I want to tell you this. Like, in my first year up there, I said to one of the cast members, I said, you know, this show we're doing, it's basically just The Wizard of Oz, right? It involves somebody, the main character, crashing in from the sky, all this other stuff, right? And interestingly enough, it was put on by this guy named Bob Kinsey. This guy, I won't even go there. That's another story. But we called him Beelzebub. And I think that technically, in terms of intelligence, he might be the smartest person I ever talked to. I mean, he was dazzlingly smart. And he was also always setting up the rules to favor him. He didn't even pay me for my first year up there until my season was almost 6 months over. He was that kind of guy, a scam artist, basically, but really, really smart and charming. But anyway, I won't go into him right now. So this is my third year up there doing the show in the character of the Night Watchman and the piano player, whatever. And, you know, so I actually said to the cast members and during my second year there, I said, you know, this is basically just The Wizard of Oz and everything. And they're like, oh, fuck, you're right. It is. It's exactly what it is. So that's kind of interesting in and of itself. But so here we are in my third year up there now. And what you have to understand about me, David, as a person, is like I am really behind the curve in terms of reality. Like I'm an extreme loner. I mostly just sit around listening to classical music and moping all the time. So, you know, I don't have any social life. I have no idea what kinds of things are going on. And I didn't have a computer until after 2001. So I'm up there in Beaver Creek, and I'm talking about movies, and everybody up there who worked up there was kids, right? Like 18, 19, 20 years old. And I was 35 at the time. So I'm talking to some young people up there about movies, right? And I'm telling them how much I love 2001, which I, at that point, still had not any idea what the fuck it meant, basically.
Right.
And that's the honest truth. Now I know, and I wish I never knew.
I don't know what the fuck that movie's about because the problem is that you give me a week and I see it a completely different way. And so that's why that I don't know what that movie's about.
Yes, you said, no, you're correct. But here's the thing. There is a punchline to the movie, David. Right? It's a very, very funny joke by Stanley Kubrick. You know in Greek theater what they did, right? When a story was too impossible and it got to a point where it couldn't be resolved, they used this thing and they called it Deus Ex Machina. Are you familiar with Deus Ex Machina?
Uh-uh.
Well, Deus Ex Machina is somehow, some people read it. And it's a Latin term that means God out of a machine. Oh, yes. Now, what would happen in these old Greek plays is that the situations, like, for instance, you know, Jason and the Argonauts or whatever, would become so outrageous that some kind of divine intervention would be needed for the characters to survive, right? So what they would do is they would build this machine, and the machine would allow an actor to be attached to wires, like wire work, and he would descend from the sky, and it was usually Zeus or Jupiter. And he would descend, and he would go, I bid all of you people that you have suffered enough, and let this, you have all been absolved of your sins, let the terrible event be remembered, and then he would be pulled back up into sky. And this technique was called Deus Ex Machina. And the whole movie, that's why he calls it a space odyssey. He's telling you, I'm just making a joke. This whole movie is about how we, and I don't know if you know this or not, but in terms of statism, like the idea of a state, every state is mythical. The social state has to be maintained by the idea that there is a truly supreme authority. Even if we don't know who that person is, if it's God or if it's Big Brother,
sure.
That person must be there to maintain state order. And this is what Kubrick is... 2001 is a sociological programming experiment. It's fucking MKUltra. It's a way to get a person to do two, and this is just my opinion, and you're welcome to disagree. And obviously, I'm talking about a person who I praise as the single greatest artist that I have any conception of. And I think it's laughable to think that I would even be able to begin to understand how smart this guy really was. So I'm not talking about it like, oh yeah, I'm a fan and I'm going to hang out with him someday.
Right.
And he's like, oh yeah, you know, you were one of my best fans and I really appreciate it. Yeah, whatever. Right. Yeah. He's going to be running away with the gold somewhere. That's what I think about Stanley Kubrick. I'll be looking around. He'll say, you were invited to attend a meeting with Stanley Kubrick. I'll go there. And then nobody will be there. I'll go to the coat check and my wallet will be gone.
You know,
that's kind of how. And
you'll get raped by George Lucas.
Well, you know, I mean, it's genius, right? Because he's a magician. That's what this guy is. He's a sleight of hand artist. And that's what he's doing. He's saying, look. This whole thing, this mythical concept of the human being, what, sure, it's real, but what difference does it make at the end of the day? All the problems that you have are the same. They are all social, and they all need some kind of resolving point. And the point that is necessary to keep the social engine moving forward is that human beings are going somewhere. They're going to the moon. They're going beyond the infinite, and then beyond that.
Right.
And that without this mechanism, and that's clearly what he's saying, the whole movie is a fucking pun. It's a three-word pun, Deus Ex Machina, God out of a machine. The HAL being the machine, representing a God who is able to see from all angles and all things and predict all things. And he knows the human beings are about to make themselves extinct. So what he does is he suckers one human being who has the actual ability to toe the line. And he suckers that person totally out of the sphere of human influence. And he gives that person godly intelligence. Well, it's Norse calling right now. Do you know how to add him?
I can ride my bike with no handlebars. No handlebars. No handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars. No handlebars. No handlebars. Look at me, look at me, hands in the air like it's good to be alive. And I'm a famous rapper even when the past are all crooked-y. I can show you how to do-si-do, I can show you how to scratch a record. I can take apart the remote control, and I can almost put it back together. I can tie a knot in a cherry stem, I can tell you about Leif Erikson. I know all the words to De Colores, and I'm proud to be an American. Me and my friends are platypus, me and my friend made a comic book. And guess how long it took, I can do anything that I want, cause look. I can keep rhythm with no metronome. No metronome, no metronome. And I can see your face on the telephone. On the telephone, on the telephone. Look at me, just called to say that it's good to be alive. In such a small world, I'm all curled up with a book to read. I can make money, open up a thrift store. I can make a living off a magazine. I can design an engine, 64 miles to a gallon of gasoline. I can make new antibiotics. I can make computers survive aquatic conditions. I know how to run the business, and I can make you want to buy a product. Movers, shakers, and producers. Me and my friends understand the future. I see the strings that control the system. I can do anything with no resistance, cause I can lead a nation with a microphone. With a microphone, with a microphone. And I can split the atom of a molecule. Of a molecule, of a molecule.
My reach is global, my tower secure. My cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations and let them all die in exasperation. Have them all healed from the lacerations, have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison just because I don't like them. And I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command because I can guide a missile by satellite, by satellite, by satellite. And I can hit a target through a telescope, through a telescope, through a telescope. And I can end the planet in a holocaust, 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 in a holocaust.
I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars.